Support this podcast via our Patreon and get more writerly goodness. Visit patreon.com/nanocast to join up.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer. I'm the author of some 27 books, 34 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this journey to raise your productivity to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 533.
Today we hear from Jeannie, who says,
how do males write female voices? How do women write men? How do straights write queer voices? How do humans make non-Earth-based beings accessible while still maintaining their otherness? How do we talk about the other and keep it both accessible and plausible?
Well, in a sense, Jeannie, the entire Deep Characterization series is about this, but I'm going to try to see if I can bring some new stuff into this and knock out your list in a fresh and interesting way. So let's talk about how a male writes a female or a female writes a male and whatnot. There's a few telltale signs that you pick up if you're reading cross-gender and the author does not really understand the way that your sex thinks. And you pick up on it because you're in the head of a character who is supposedly someone who's got something very basically biological in common with you, and it's not panning out. Women complain about male authors doing this. They say they write men with boobs when they write really well-developed female characters who seem to read as if they're basically men, except that they're in a female body. And men don't usually complain out loud about it, but women do exactly the transverse, and I would say chicks with dicks, except that's a whole porn genre and has other connotations. But women tend to write men who feel a lot more like women than the women reading and writing realize. Now, this isn't universal. There are a lot of authors who have figured out the tricks. And in addition to some of the basic stuff you can do, like socializing heavily with the opposite sex, especially in circumstances where your sex is not obvious to them. I'll give you an example. When I was in college, I took a poetry course that was entirely populated by women. Female professor, all the other students were females. I was the only male in the room. After the first day, when I realized this, I always sat in the back row because they forget I was there. And I would watch and listen to them talk. I'd listen to them interpret and explicate poems. And I really marinated in the thought process and the way they thought, because I grew up with three brothers. All my socialization with women and with girls came due to family, friends, and aunts and cousins and things like that. And that was a fairly rare occurrence because I had three brothers, and compared to the amount of time I spent with them every day, I didn't have a lot of experience with women in any sense. So this was a hell of an education for me. And one of the things that became clear really quickly that I since found out has a lot of neurological substrate underlying it is women tend to be really focused on the emotions of the people around them. They are, compared to men, hugely empathetic. That doesn't mean that men don't care about people or that women do care about people. What it means is that women are more sensitive to the emotional states on a moment-to-moment basis of the people around them, whereas men tend to be more interested in, you can see, and this goes way back deep in evolutionary history. If you give baby chimps Tonka trucks and dolls, the girl chimps will play with the dolls, and the boy chimps will play with the Tonka trucks. And they'll have very little crossover interest between the two. And there's no socialization that goes on with chimpanzees. There's a few reasons that this might be the case. And whether or not any or all of them prove to be exactly right, they do sort of capture a way of thinking about what's going on underneath and how and why it expresses itself in social contexts and in thought patterns, and that can be really useful for helping to solidify the believability of your cross-gender characters. So, for example, look at gaze tracking between the sexes. This all ties in together, I promise. Gaze tracking research is where psychologists put a little camera on your eyes to follow where you're looking at any given point. And in the late 90s and early 2000s, this became a real big area of research. And one of the things that they found was that in casual conversation, men and women have very distinctive gaze tracking patterns. They have different saccades. A saccade is when you move your eyes and you're not aware of it. You build up your visual picture of the environment in your brain by taking little snapshots around the environment and stitching them together on the fly in your visual cortex. And the things that you focus on are the things that your brain is telling you are important to keep track of. Women tend to focus on the eyes, the mouth, the shoulders, and the hands, a little bit on the chest and upper torso area. Men tend to focus on the face as a whole, the shoulders and chest, and the genitals. And this pattern is true whether you're talking about strangers talking, or friends talking, or lovers talking, or places where there's sexual interest or no sexual interest. Women are focusing on the areas that are best for reading intent. Social cues. They're trying to find out what comes next. And why would they do that? Well, generally speaking, women are smaller and less powerful physically. So if they're in a context with someone who's larger than they are, they need to know what that person is going to do 4 or 5 seconds from now. Because if that person is going to do something untoward, they need to get out of the way or preemptively attack. And because they are smaller and less powerful, they also live in a world that is highly political. Female relationships in social groups tend to be highly dynamic and very political. Everybody is interested in what everybody else is thinking, what everybody else's relationship status is. All of it is intelligence for sorting out who's in the pecking order and where they are in the pecking order and who's currently on the outs. And the situations are evolved to suit the needs of the moment according to what the needs of the people higher up in the pecking order are, or the people who are interested in turning the pecking order over. If you want to understand female social dynamics, read Danielle Steele. Her books are completely schlocky and soap opera-y, and they populate an entire world where everybody relates to each other according to the rules of female socialization in a sort of cartoony fashion. Men, on the other hand, are much more interested not in their moment-to-moment safety and in the political games that are going on between themselves. They're interested in who's in charge in a given situation. Because if you're a guy amongst other guys and you transgress the pack order, you could get punched in the face. And then once the punching in the face is done, everything else is fine. But there is a distinct physicality and implicit violence in male relationships that does not exist in female relationships, which is one of the reasons that men who bond on the battlefield or bond through a shared experience of violence, like in gang situations or other things like that, sports situations is a shared experience of violence. Men who bond through an experience of being on the same side of a violent altercation tend to have more solid bonds with each other than almost any other kind of male friendship. Whether they were victims together in some situation or whether they were perpetrators together in some situation, sharing the experience of depending upon each other in an intense physical conflict goes right to the deep basal level of the male brain, and that's what male friendships are generally founded upon. That or the father-son dynamic, the teaching and learning. So in any given social situation with men, you're going to have a distinct pack order that might be subtle, and it might change all the time, depending on whose area of expertise you're in. So if you've got two people talking, great example. I have a cousin who is a master craftsman carpenter. He's just getting interested in philosophy. I am a major philosophy nut. I am just seriously getting into carpentry. And we sat on this very porch where I'm sitting now a few weeks ago, and we talked for 5 hours, had a great time. During the conversation, who was in charge traded off depending on which subject area we were in. If we were in carpentry area, I was protege, student, son figure, and he was teacher, mentor, father figure. And then when we switched to philosophy, it was exactly the opposite. It's not that he was talking down to me on carpentry and I was talking down to him on philosophy. It's that I was using him as a conduit to explore the area of his expertise, and he was using me as a conduit to explore the area of mine. So because men are object-focused, they view the world in a much more instrumental fashion. Because women are relationship-focused, they view the world much more empathetically. Remember, empathy doesn't mean care. You can be very empathetic and not care about somebody. Empathetic means you're very aware of what they're feeling because you feel a resonance in yourself. You can use that either to care about somebody or to really screw somebody over. Men tend to be more sympathetic and less empathetic. Men will observe how someone's feeling and attempt to intervene either in a good way or a bad way. And that's because of the instrumentality, but they feel the emotional state of the other person less keenly than a woman in the same situation would do, all other things being equal. And of course, there are men and women who are more or less neurotypical. People who are autistic tend to be far more masculine-brained, whether they're male or female. Youngest children in a family of all boys tend to be far more feminine-brained, whether they're male or female. And that has a lot to do with the fetal testosterone environment and other things like that. So if you're attempting to write cross-gender and you manage to nail the gaze tracking, you're going to get a quick in with readers of the opposite sex because they will identify that as being genuine and ringing true without really knowing why they're really buying into what you're doing. And if you get the sort of emotional landscape of object-oriented versus people-oriented more or less correct, you're also going to get your readers to buy into what you're doing even though you're writing cross-genders. You may stumble a bit early on by going too stereotypical one way or another, because if you go too stereotypical, of course, you're going to lose your audience, depending on the area of the stereotype. But to go back to gaze tracking, in addition to reading pack hierarchy, men are always trying to read the sexual status and interest of the person they're talking to, even if they're not interested in them sexually. It's just how the brain is wired. Women, you notice, I didn't say they look at the genitals, because they don't, or men always do. Whether it's a guy or a girl, whether the guy is heterosexual or homosexual, they always just include the genitals and the things to check out. Because among guys, it's a status thing, and among women, it's an interest thing. Because you gotta remember, we evolved before clothing, and you can observe female arousal. And of course, the chest, because with chest, you observe the center of gravity in guys. You can tell what their posture is and how domineering they're being. And in women, it's a sexual interest thing as well. Whereas women tend not to be visually sexually interested in someone on a genital level until they are already aroused. And then the gaze tracking pattern shifts, and you can actually gauge the level of arousal in a woman if you're using a gaze tracking setup, which, you know, you can't do this casually. But in a laboratory environment, you can observe the arousal level simply by noting where the gaze rests and when genitals come into the normal saccade pattern. Now, the gaze tracking thing is so fundamental to the neurological architecture that it's one of the ways that you can diagnose someone who is transsexual on a biological level. It's not the only way, and it's not the most reliable way. It's not one of the four standard tests they use, but it is something that accords really, really closely with the neurological substrate. So if you're writing a transgender character who is transgendered because that's the way they were born, rather than because they have very complicated emotional problems, then that's one of the ways that you can sell that this character is really a transgendered character by giving them the typical gaze tracking pattern of the opposite sex from that which they embody. Now, when you're talking about queer characters, of course, that's become a basket term, so it really depends on what you're talking about. But generally speaking, unless you're talking about someone who is transsexual, their gaze patterns and their thought patterns will broadly fit their gender type. They may be sort of out on one end or another of the bell curve, but they're going to be broadly typical of the way their gender thinks, except perhaps when it comes to issues of sexual attraction and cultural baggage that is accompanied therewith depending on the character's culture and subculture of origin and what kind of guilt they carry around because of it or not, or carry around and are deliberately reacting to defiantly. There's a whole bunch of deep characterization stuff you can get into on that level. But someone's sexual preferences, unless you're writing erotica, they're generally not what you want to lead with in characterization, because most people, and I say most because there are some of the outliers, most people, most of the time, are not performing their sexual preference socially. They'll do that in situations where there's a mating ritual going on, you know, pickup bars, dating situation. If they're at a convention for people who are of a similar preference and nature to them, whether it's a queer convention or a kink convention or poly convention or whatnot. But generally speaking, you're not going to have your characters in a situation where their sexuality is the lead item on their mental agenda. Unless they're in a situation like that, if sexuality is the lead item on their mental agenda, they are either someone who is unusually highly sexed, and these people do exist, in both sexes, though they're more common in males than in females, or they're people who are a little emotionally disturbed and are sort of hiding behind their sexuality as a way to avoid dealing with their life. Those are both rich fields for characterization, but unless you're doing someone who is in one of those categories as your point of view character, then their internal mental life is going to be fairly like a run-of-the-mill male or female from their culture on that part of the bell curve, wherever that is they fall on the masculine versus feminine neurotype. Now, that said, one of the things you do notice socially, and this is the basis for a fairly awful stereotype, but the stereotype is based on something that's much subtler, and it's one of those things you can't avoid growing up in San Francisco. During mating rituals, people who are gay or lesbians, or who are bisexuals who are going after a member of the same sex at that particular point, will tend to either become exaggeratedly typical of their sex or exaggeratedly signaling of the opposite sex. The gay lisp that we've all heard about, that's kind of stereotypical, that actually occurs across a lot of cultures in the world, and it's a way of signaling, usually subtly, unless you're in an intensive gay subculture, in which case it has some other social functions. It's a way of signaling to people that are listening for it that you are interested in guys, if you're a guy. The Bull Dyke stereotype is a exaggeratedly masculine way of behaving that is designed to attract femme lesbians, because you're indicating your preference by taking on the opposite role. It's a social performative thing. Now, social performative doesn't necessarily mean it's conscious. If the person in question is more feminine-brained if they're a gay male, or more masculine-brained if they're a lesbian, they could be entirely unconscious. Usually it's a little bit of both. They've found something that works, they don't know exactly why, but it feels good, so that's their social performance, that's the persona they put on, as we all put on social performances and personas in order to signal to the people around us what kind of people we are and what kind of interactions we're seeking. So those are things that are worth bearing in mind if you're writing a queer character and you're straight. And of course, you can flip that map around if you're queer and you're writing a straight character. But it's also worth pointing out that the gender performance in a mating ritual situation does not necessarily correlate to the gender roles in a solidified relationship. The femme-performing guy might be the bottom in bed, might, but isn't necessarily, but he might be the more masculine person in the relationship on a social basis. That part of the equation varies a lot from couple to couple and from person to person. Generally speaking, when queer people get together, there is usually a more masculine and a more feminine partner in the relationship, but it doesn't necessarily map straight to the social performance during the mating ritual. It's a lot more of a subtle dance of intimacy that goes on with that. So those are some tips for writing queer characters if you're straight. And again, if you're writing straight characters and you're queer, you want to sort of flip that around and make it a point, especially if you live within a queer community, make it a point to socialize in straight circles in a way that actually brings you in contact, not just with gender performance mating rituals, which you can see exemplified in a cartoonish form in the popular media all the time, just like straight people can see gay mating rituals cartoonified in popular media all the time. But on a more personal day-to-day basis, watching couples and triples and quadruples and whatnot interact, watching groups of friends who are the same sexual orientation interact with each other, the social dynamics are different depending on what that sexual orientation is. But as long as you're not talking about transgender folk, there'll be a lot of similarities underneath the surface-level social grammar. And the other thing about queer characters and culture is that it's highly conditioned by the broader culture that it exists within the context of. Gender roles vary to a certain extent from culture to culture, and the more of a micro level you get down onto, the broader the variance is. And so the social performance crossing gender lines is dependent upon what the gender lines are in that culture and how gender is considered and defined. That could bring us into some other really weird areas, but I'll leave that alone for this because this is not a episode dealing exclusively with the complex adaptations that cultures make to control and channel sexuality. So, moving on to your last question, which is aliens. Well, that's going to depend on who your alien species is, why they're that way, and whatnot. And the best recommendation I can make from that is to do as you would if you were building a human culture. Start with the biology, look at the geography, the physical conditions under which that biology is forced to create a culture, and allow the culture to grow from the interaction between the needs of the biology and the realities of the geography in which it's instantiated. Dune is a fantastic example of this. Frank Herbert did such a fantastic job with cultural development in Dune, specifically because he paid so much attention to the interaction between biology and geography, the environment, the physical environment, the climate, the mountains, the sands in which the different cultures found themselves living. Culture grows out always of the interaction between biology and geography. So if you start your alien species that way, and remember also that to a certain extent, the biology has arisen from the geography, insofar as the life form that you're talking about has evolved in that environment and has adapted to it, or has transplanted from another environment and has to make adaptations of the environment to themselves. Those sets of interactions will give you the culture, and that will give you the window into the thought processes that help you create an effective characterization. Great question. Thank you very much for sending it in. I hope it was useful. If you're interested in more of this stuff, be sure to check out the Deep Characterization series, which I have set a goal for myself to finish up by Thanksgiving this year. So that'll be coming to a close. I've got 3 episodes left, and I've just been putting it off because they're all really deep dive doozies, and I'm trying to figure out how to concentrate them down into a time factor that would be appropriate for this podcast. Thanks very much for sending it in, and I'll see you tomorrow. The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2018 by J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2018 Artistic Whispers Productions. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.